Hello and welcome back to Archaeology News Weekly. I am, as ever, your host, David Connolly. Now, you've been probably wondering exactly where I have been. Well, can't say too much, but my dulcet tones have been used to good effect, if not my face, as I have been presenting a pilot for a new archaeology series. Let's say I think I'd be better as a podcast presenter. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. We did some great archaeology with some great people down in Wales. So thanks to everybody. You know who you are and just what you did. We did an amazing job, found amazing things, lived in amazing places and saw amazing views. But you don't want to hear about that. You want to hear about the news. So without further ado, this news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories, of course, have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. Of course, you can't forget the Archaeo News app. It's archaeology news in your pocket. More on that later, however. So let's start with what we can learn from reindeer teeth holding clues to Neanderthal hunting tactics. Then we delve into Costa Rica's ancient cultures and prehistory. Debate continues to rage over growth of an Aboriginal population in Australia. And continuing the theme of controversy, did the Japanese come from Korea? And I've just lost it there for a second. A Neolithic tomb is excavated in Orkney, and a Cornish Bronze Age hoard is put on display. We head back to a 7,000-year-old village in the east, unearthed in Kurdistan, and then return to an ancient lost civilization in Cuba. Credit where credit's due, as Ohio's mounds are hailed as works of art, and Heidelberg Man's links humans and Neanderthals, a new study shows. And the oldest remains of Caspian horses are discovered in Iran, while we also have an amazing find with 25,000-year-old cave paintings discovered in Spain. Equally as good, of course, and that's because it's in Scotland, we've got an ancient Broch settlement occupied for 1,000 years being investigated. And a Celtic grave is examined by German archaeologists. Quite an amazing story, that one. Finally, how could we not end with a story about bog butter found in Ireland? Well, you'll just have to wait to the end to find out all about it. But remember, you could be listening to this on the Stone Pages Archaeo News app, as well as keeping up with the news as it happens. So let's start off today's podcast. Analysis of subtle chemical variations in reindeer teeth suggests that Neanderthals employed sophisticated hunting strategies, similar to the tactics used later by modern humans. Kate Britton, an archaeologist at the University of Aberdeen, wanted to find out more about adult reindeer remains by looking at the chemical composition of their teeth from a 70,000-year-old lair at the Jonzac Neanderthal hunting camp in France, a rock shelter believed to have been used over a long period of time. Teeth contained calcium, phosphorus, oxygen, strontium, and other elements, but not all the atoms of each element are the same. Some atoms or isotopes are heavier than others and may have slightly different chemical properties. And Britton explained that strontium in bones and teeth is related to the food and water that you consume and thus to the underlying soil and rocks of a particular area. It's possible to look at the strontium isotopes and find out if the animals ate and drank in the same area or if they moved around. The reindeer have similar strontium isotope patterns, suggesting that they move from one area to another and back again while their teeth were developing. The reindeer were probably travelling through an area during their annual migrations. The Neanderthal must have been aware of these reindeer migration patterns and planned their occupation of an area based on the movement of the herd. This sophisticated hunting behaviour is something we normally see later in the Upper Paleolithic amongst modern human groups, and it's fascinating to see that Neanderthals may have been employing similar strategies. Three archaeological sites in Costa Rica are providing a glimpse into life before European conquest. Guayabo de Turrialba, Lake Arenal, and the Nicoya Peninsula are these three. Ceramics dating from 300 BCE found near Guanacaste on the Nicoya Peninsula provide evidence of interaction between the Olmecs and the earliest Costa Ricans. Lake Arenal, known for the volcano that looms over the valley, became the focus of Payson Sheets, an archaeologist from the University of Colorado. Using NASA remote sensing technology, Sheets discovered the existence of remote footpaths both around and even under the current lake during aerial surveys way back in 1985. Sheets and other behavioural archaeologists theorised that wandering bands may have lived around the volcano as early as 10,000 BCE, although a permanent settlement probably did not become established until around 2000 BCE. Guayabo de Turrialba is a 219-hectare site on the southern slopes of the Turrialba volcano. Only about 10% of the site has been excavated as yet, established and inhabited somewhere around 1500 BCE. At its height, it may have been occupied by as many as 10 to 25,000 people, yet the entire site seems to have been abandoned by 1400 CE, nearly a century before the Spanish arrived. Guayabo's stone streets, structures, water cisterns and petroglyphs provide evidence of a thriving society. On a final interesting note, the evidence from the petroglyphs suggests that there was a dual power structure. The political chief, known as the Cayque, and the religious and spiritual leader called the Saman. I really must get over to that island one day. In fact, I must really try and get over to the Americas one day. Now to Australia, where a great debate is underway following the use of a new mathematical model which has been used to predict the growth patterns of the native Australian Aboriginal population in the time prior to the arrival of Europeans. The model's author is ecologist Professor Christopher Johnson of the University of Tasmania. His paper was accepted by the Royal Society back in April and is published online. He contends that the previous use of radiocarbon dating to predict population growth is flawed, as it does not take into account loss of evidence from older sites. He claims that his mathematical model, developed in conjunction with Professor Barry Brook of the University of Adelaide, has allowed for this, and he predicts that the Aboriginal population growth through the Holocene was exponential, i.e. increasing at an increasing rate, quoting a growth rate of 10 to 40% per thousand year over the last 10,000 years. One of the most vehement opponents to this theory is archaeologist Dr. Sean Ulm of James Cook University, who claims that the model does not take into account regional variability and the research was focused only on rock shelters while ignoring settlements and open sites. What is certain is that this debate has a long way yet to run, and also, I have no idea what it all means. I feel I better brush up on my statistical modelling mathematics. A team of researchers have been delving into the origins of the Japanese people, with some interesting finds. The research was centred on a study of Japanese dialects with the aim of finding the roots of the language. The language family is known as Japonic, and this includes Japanese and a similar language called Ryukyuan. I probably said that horribly wrong, which is spoken in the chain of islands to the south of Japan. Do please get in touch and tell me how I should have said that, by the way. Whilst genetically the modern Japanese are descended from two main migrant streams, the Jomon culture and the Yayoi culture, the linguistic roots were provided by the Yayoi. The hunter-gatherer Jomons were the first to arrive using land bridges at the end of the last ice age. They were joined approximately 2,400 years ago by the agricultural Yayoi. Whilst there is almost equitable genetic evidence of both cultures in the modern Japanese population, it is the Yayoi language which is the stronger. The Yayoi can be traced back to the Korean Peninsula, and it's this link that the Japanese used to justify the occupation of Korea and Manchuria during the Second World War. The linguistic link was provided by a method known as Bayesian philology. This uses a computer to map several language trees using a limited vocabulary of approximately 200 words, which are known to evolve slowly. by feeding all the data from the dialect studies into a computer model, a date of 2,182 years ago was predicted for the origin of Japonic, and this fits very neatly with the arrival of the Yayoi. Whilst John B. Whitman of the National Institute for Japanese Language and Linguistics in Tokyo refers to the results as solid and reasonable, other linguists are far more sceptical. Here we go with statistics again. Well, no statistics involved here, as we have a Neolithic tomb excavated in Orkneys of Scotland. Excavations have recently been carried out at a Stone Age tomb on South Ronaldsay in the Orkney Islands. The team is from the Orkney Research Centre for Archaeology, commonly known as ORCA. Unfortunately, most previous excavations in the area have found that vital evidence was destroyed by 19th century antiquarian excavators. But this particular tomb, located at a place called Banks, was untouched, and it was hoped that DNA analysis and other modern techniques could be employed to great effect. Their hopes were justified, and during the first phase of excavation, the remains of at least 8 people were uncovered, followed by over 1,000 pieces of human bones. However, the team had to work fast as the tomb had remained sealed, and it was believed that exposure to modern atmosphere could have devastating effects. The tomb proved to be complex and had several burial cells clustered around a central passage, which was approached via an entrance passage itself. The finds in one of the cells, the west one, were particularly interesting. This was the lowest part of the tomb complex and was waterlogged. This was a multi-layered burial chamber used over a long period of time, with each burial being covered in layers of silt before the next occurred. The archaeologists believed that the use of a waterlogged chamber was deliberate and was linked to the ritual activities there. But this was not the end of the intriguing story of the West Cell. In addition to the human remains, evidence of otters were also found in such a way that suggests that the human occupants allowed the otters to come and go as they pleased. The significance of this remains a mystery. And by the way, when I say the human occupants, I'm not meaning the ones that are lying there dead. It's the ones that were burying them, of course. Dan Lee, lovely man, the team leader, is quoted as saying, because the conditions are changing inside, there's now a real danger that they're going to lose key information. The next stage will be to fully excavate the passageway and the entrance, and we hope to get back in the autumn of this year, he said, or at least the spring of next, and continue to work on this fascinating piece of Stone Age archaeology. You can read all about this one in a fabulous article on Past Horizons. You know where it is, www.pasthorizons.com, which also has some amazing images and video footage exclusive to Past Horizons. Now, a Bronze Age hoard uncovered by a gardener on the island of Cornwall in England in 2009 is now on public display. The collection of 49 artefacts found on St Michael's Mount is on display in the island's castle. Pieces including axe heads, daggers, ingots and a complete metal clasp have been verified by the British Museum as being, 3,000 years old. Archaeologists said the objects probably belonged to a smith who had hidden them away for later use, a so-called founder's hoard. The objects were discovered by Darren Little when he was clearing bracken and found an opening in a rock. He's quoted as saying that he first found a small axe head and after some more investigation, that's firkling to you and me, found ingots, pieces of swords and chisels. Although the age of the objects has been identified, archaeologists said that they were not sure how they came to be where they were found. National Trust archaeologist Jim Parry said they could have been stashed away when he was doing a deal and he didn't want to bring them with him, or could have been a bit of safe overnight storage. There's much to learn about these hoards, and it becomes more and more important to ensure that they are recorded and even excavated in situ to try and explain the mystery. At the end of 2010, archaeologist Nadir Babakir carefully investigated a hill in the Hasarok Quarter, a new area on the eastern outskirts of Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. After some initial research, Babakir was convinced the hill was an archaeological site, and a short time later, a team from the Directorate of Archaeology confirmed it. The new site was named Nadir after Babakir himself, as legislation in Kurdistan The government names the archaeological sites after the person who discovers them as a way to honour those that inform the authorities. The Directorate of Archaeology signed an agreement with the University of Athens to excavate the site, and a team has been excavating there for a month. In a recent press conference, the director of the Greek team, Dr. Costa, announced that initial investigation has put the age of the site at around 7,000 years. Costa said that more than 1,000 archaeological artefacts have been found at the site, including ceramics, animal paintings, faunal remains, and even fragments of human skeletons. The excavation itself is around 10,000 square metres, and the team will return in October to continue the excavations. Work on the site is expected to continue for 5 years at least. Kurdistan has at least 1,307 known archaeological sites. Among the most famous, of course, are Erbil Citadel, the oldest continuously inhabited settlement in the world, which was settled around 6,000 BCE. Another, of course, is the Shanidar Cave, where 9 Neanderthal skeletons were found, dating back to 60,000 to 80,000 years ago. So there's plenty still to find in Iraqi Kurdistan. Now, during the 1950s, Cuban divers and underwater archaeologists found extensive artifactual evidence of a Native American civilization on the western end of Cuba that was different and more advanced than the Chino-Arawak people who migrated to the island around 900 CE. Their theories were based on the likelihood that Cuba may have functioned as a gateway of ideas, crops and peoples for all of the Americas. Cuba's only 90 miles from the Florida Keys and 96 miles from the Yucatan Peninsula. In the late 1990s, Russian-Canadian oceanographer-engineer Paulina Zelitsky used underwater cameras to film structures in 2,200 feet of water, which seemed to be pyramids, plazas, mounds and terraces. The November 2002 issue of the National Geographic contained an article on the discovery, and it was speculated that the ruins were 6,000 years old. There was, however, no scientific proof of that assigned date. The article inferred that only people from the old world could have built such structures, and failed to mention the large structures being built in North America 6,000 years ago. None of the materials in the apparent structures have been brought to the surface for scientific dating, and little has been done since then to confirm the exact nature of the underwater structures themselves. During the past decade, anthropological research has tended to support the theory by Cuban archaeologists that their island was an ancient crossroads of advanced indigenous culture. In 2005, the University of Alabama carried out joint studies with Cuban archaeologists on several sites, and it was determined that prior to being exterminated by Spanish invaders, the native peoples of Cuba were skilled farmers and built some stone architecture, but normally tended to live in small villages so that they could maintain a sustainable relationship with the environment. Until comprehensive archaeological studies are carried out along the western coast of Cuba, the possibility of a lost civilization must remain in the realm of speculation. Cuba's economy is transforming, but it still cannot afford the expenditure of an investigation into this hypothesis. The most likely model for a large-scale archaeological study to take place would be similar to the University of Alabama's joint project with these Cuban archaeologists, but this time with several universities from several nations being involved. Well, you can also count me in as well. My Indiana Jones hat is ready, packed, and my trowel is always on offer. Now, returning to this concept that somehow there was no real culture in the past in the Americas, let's head to Ohio. For many people, the earthen mounds of eastern North America are nothing like the architectural wonders of Europe in Asia. Compared to the Parthenon of Athens or Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, Ohio's Newark earthworks and Fort Ancient just seem like piles of dirt. However, new research is revealing surprising sophistication in the form and structure of ancient American earthen architecture. Archaeologists Sarah Sherwood of Dickinson College and Tristan Kidder of Washington University revealed the complexity of earthworks from Poverty Point in Louisiana to the Cahokia Mounds of Illinois in their paper, Da Vinci's of Dirt, published in the latest Journal of Anthropological Archaeology. Mound building required a planned effort that incorporated site preparation, sophisticated understanding of soil properties, and considerable engineering skills. Sherwood and Kidder argued that ancient American Indian mound builders were highly selective in their choice of dirt and had a comprehensive knowledge of the structure and availability of local geological materials. At Newark's Great Circle, for example, dark brown earth from the uppermost soil layers forms the outer portion of the circle, while bright yellow-brown earth from deep beneath the surface forms the inner portion. Earthworks also might show evidence of thoughtful engineering using a variety of techniques such as mixing different types of soil together to create a stronger material for mound building and cutting and stacking blocks of sod to help stabilize the steep slopes of an embankment. The soil colours at Great Circle likely conveyed important symbolic information. Moreover, Newark's octagon earthworks are aligned to the rising and setting of the moon over an 18.6-year cycle, which also suggests a spiritual component to the architecture. The fact that these ancient Americans chose earth as their medium of expression should in no way detract from their amazing achievements. One fact, those that feel that old world intervention should keep in mind. This is not a lost tribe of Egyptians, it's not a lost tribe of Israelites, it's not even Knights Templars. It's time to give credit where credit is really due. Now, the last common ancestor of humans and Neanderthals was a well-travelled species called Heidelberg Man. This is according to a new study. The evolutionary split between Neanderthals and modern humans may have occurred around 400,000 years ago. The determination is based on the remains of a single Heidelberg man, Homo heidelbergensis, known as Ceprano, named after the town near Rome in Italy, where his fossil, a partial cranium, was found. Previously, this 400,000-year-old fossil was thought to represent a new species of human, Homo capreensis. The latest study, however, identifies them as an archaic member of Homo heidelbergensis. The findings may shed light on what the species that gave rise to both Neanderthals and Homo sapiens looked like. Anthropologists believe that Heidelberg man was tall, had a strong jaw and had small teeth as well. Researchers believe that Homo heidelbergensis was widespread, dispersing throughout Eurasia and Africa around 780,000 years ago. Good weather may have permitted Heidelberg man's worldly lifestyle, favouring expansion and contact between populations. While many eyes are on Heidelberg man as being the likely common ancestor to Neanderthals and our species, the jury is still out as to where that evolution took place. Now to Iran. In Gohartepe, in northern Iranian province of Mazandaran, archaeologists have discovered the remains of the oldest breed of horse in the world still in existence, the Caspian, also known as the Mazandaran horse. The 50-hectare Gohartepe site is located in the eastern part of the province between the cities of Necha and Beshahr. It's one of the most important archaeological sites in Iran, located near the Caspian Sea. It's also believed that Gohartepe once enjoyed a complicated urbanization some 6,500 to 7,000 years ago. The remains were discovered in a cemetery dating back to the late Bronze and Early Iron Age, around 3,400 BCE. The Caspian, or King's Horse, was celebrated in ancient Iran as a chariot horse for racing and in battle, and presented to kings and queens as a valuable gift. It was also known to be favoured by Darius the Great. The breed was thought to have disappeared until 1965, when Louise Farouz, the American wife of an Iranian aristocrat, discovered the small horses in a mountainous region south of the Caspian Sea. Smaller than modern horses, standing only 11.3 hands high, that's about 115 centimetres, compared to the modern racehorse, which is 16 hands, or 163 centimetres high, the Caspians have light frames, thin bones, a short, fine head with a pronounced forehead, large eyes, short ears, and small muzzles. They're fast, strong, and spirited. I know a person just like that. Paintings depicting horses and human hands made by prehistoric humans around 25,000 years ago have been discovered in a cave in northern Spain. The red paintings, found by chance by archaeologists looking for signs of ancient occupation, were made around the same time as the Altamira cave paintings, some of the world's best prehistoric paintings discovered in Spain in 1879. It was a chance finding, said archaeologist Diego Garate. Although they were difficult to spot because they're badly deteriorated, our experienced eye helped us to identify them. Experts will further explore the case for evidence of prehistoric tools as well. Well, if only we could sell experienced eyes at past horizons. We just have to make do with our trowels, I'm afraid. The site of Scotland's most important mainland Brock settlement may have been home to early people for up to 1,000 years, new evidence suggests. Archaeologists and volunteers have uncovered what could be the remains of walls dating back to 700 to 500 BCE at Nibster in Caithness, up in the north of Scotland. Andy Heald of AOC Archaeology, hello Andy, said further investigations would be needed to confirm the structure's age. A key feature of the site are the remains of a massive stone wall roundhouse known as a broch. Mr. Heldon said that he believed the site may have been occupied long before the Iron Age and provided habitation to various communities for 1,000 years. He is reported as saying, "We've dug down to what might have been the earliest wall on the site, and this wall may have been used to seal off the site as a territory, as if someone was saying, 'This land is mine.'" Typical of sites like this, it was reused and modified at different times. Nibster is one of Scotland's most important mainland broch settlements. Archaeologists are wary of any alterations that may have been made to the site during excavations led by Sir Francis Tress Barry in the early 19th century. A series of stone steps that may have been constructed on Sir Francis's instructions have been uncovered at the settlement. According to an obituary written following his death in 1907, Sir Francis found the remains of elk, wolf, wild boar and great auk, an extinct seabird. Older artefacts found at the site include the core of a cannel coal bracelet. The smooth circular disc was cut to create the hole in the bracelet itself, but it also suggests trade between the residents of Nibster and other parts of the Highlands, because the nearest source of cannel coal is 50 miles away. Now to Germany, and I hope you've been keeping up with this story. German experts are carefully taking apart a complete grave of a Celtic woman in the hope of finding out more about her way of life 2,600 years ago. She rested in peace until a few months ago when her grave was removed in its entirety, all 80 tons of it, and transported on the back of a truck to Ludwigsburg near Stuttgart. In the grave too was a child that's presumed to be hers. The archaeologists decided that removal of the whole grave would allow them to use the most modern resources of analysis, from computers to x-rays. What emerged was the lady, the child and the ornaments. Because of the amount of gold and amber jewellery, they are assumed to be important, a princess and a young prince or princess. It indicates that the early Celts had an aristocratic hierarchy, which has been a matter of dispute amongst archaeologists. "It's the oldest princely female grave yet from the Celtic world," said Dr. Dirk Kraus, who is in charge of the dig. The archaeologists are excited because the grave was preserved by the water-sodden soil in the region, so that even the oak floor was intact, which allowed for an exact dendrochronological date. That's tree ring dating to you and me. The oak trees being felled 2,620 years ago. So, assuming that they were actually felled for the grave itself, the woman died around 609 BCE. The grave had also not been robbed down these 26 centuries, unlike many others, which meant that the jewellery was still there, with beautiful brooches of ornate Celtic design in gold and amber. Dr. Kraus says that the real Celtic heartland was actually in the region in the upper reaches of the Danube, where the Celts would have traded from. Nicole Ebinger-Rest has been doing much of the painstaking excavation, and what excited her were the specks of cloth and food, as well as other organic material that will reveal an entirely new way of life. So, all treasure is not gold, and it's certainly not here. Now, finally, over £100 pounds of bog butter have been discovered in Tullymore, County Offaly in Ireland. This ancient food substance, buried as a form of refrigeration, is thought to be 5,000 years old. Brian Clancy and his uncle Joe were cutting turf in Ballard Bog when they made the discovery. Joe then went on to explain, "We were cutting turf and I found what looked like a huge piece of timber. We took it out with our spade and it turned out to be bog butter. When the men found the container, Joe returned to his house, researched everything about bog butter on the internet, and returned to the bog and filled a wheelbarrow with peat and then placed the keg into it. He then brought it home and contacted the National Museum of Ireland. The container has carved marks around the edges and then a removable lid with handles and holes, possibly for carrying. The wooden vessel measures a foot in diameter and is almost 2 feet tall. The 100-pound container was buried 7 feet down in the peat. Some people believe that bog butter was a special type of butter made at a certain time during the year and buried so that it might be preserved. Joe said that the butter still had a dairy smell to it. But in the past, some bog butter has been tested, has been shown to have meat base to it. Yum. I'll have that on my toast. Anyway, don't not forget that our news is available on the iPhone, iPod Touch and iPad. Have a look at www.stonepages.com/app. And of course, what's stopping you from going to Past Horizons? Nothing, I hear you say. So get along there to www.pasthorizons.com, where you will find the best and best written articles, best written news on the web, he says, hopefully. I, of course, could be slightly biased. Can I remind people, of course, and here I am completely biased, that there are many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as the fabulous Badger Federation Forum on Badger, www.bajr.org. And more can always be found at Stone Pages, news.stonepages.com. Thanks for listening to Archaeology News Weekly, and I hope to return to you next week.